Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you all for standing by. During today's conference, all participant lines will be in a listen-only mode. We'll conduct a question and answer session at the end of the presentation. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your phone. This conference is being recorded. If anyone has got any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now hand the call over to Marcus Hart. Please go ahead, sir. Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome to our latest trustee teleconference. My name is Marcus Hart, and I'm a principal and actuary here at Aon Hewitt. My role today here is to chair this, the latest in our series of quarterly calls, in which we look at a number of hot issues in pensions. These calls are intended to supplement our trustee training courses and provide a bit of background, and hopefully today we'll add a little bit of insight as well into those topical challenges that are facing pension scheme trustees at this current time. Now, we're going to focus mainly on the trustees' viewpoint, but we'll also try and throw in a few reflections from the employer's perspective as well. There will be an opportunity to ask questions towards the end of today's teleconference, but as we're going along, if you'd like to jot down your thoughts, then when we open the line later, then hopefully there'll be an opportunity for questions. So then, without further ado, I'll introduce our panel of speakers this morning. And joining me on the call today are Oliver Walker and Paul McGlone. Ollie is an actuary in our corporate pensions practice, specializing in advice to employers of defined benefit pension schemes. He advises a wide spectrum of DB sponsors, but particularly employers in the financial services sector. Although when I was pushing him on this earlier, he claimed the recent financial crisis is absolutely nothing to do with him.
Thanks, Marcus.
We're hoping for some interesting views from Ollie, and in particular, I'm hoping that we might be able to get an inside scoop on where employers are likely to be coming from on the quickly approaching 2012 funding negotiations. We also have with us today Paul McGlone. Now, Paul is a scheme actuary to a number of DB schemes, but to my mind, I think he's probably best known for his regular comments to the media, and in particular, his crowning moment, which is when he had his picture in Professional Pensions just above the caption, "Interesting." Well, we'll live to see whether we can live up to that challenge when we ask him to cover GMP equalisation in a few minutes' time. So that introduces the panellists. So I think let's get on to the main themes of today. As part of today's discussion, we're going to cover GMP equalisation, so what we have learnt from the recent consultation and what, if anything, trustees should be doing now to respond to that consultation. We're going to look at funding valuations in 2012, so what to expect amidst all of this market turmoil and new ways in which you might wish to approach funding valuations. Thirdly, we'll have a look at the Aon Hewitt Mid-Market Survey, because we've had a number of really interesting findings from that survey, and we thought they'd be worth sharing with you today. And then finally, we'll have a look at the recent budget, of course. We'll have a look at what the main outputs were or what the implications are for all of us. So, first on our list of four is GMP equalisation, and in my introduction I described Paul's claim to fame as being labelled interesting. But here's a real challenge for you, Paul. If you can make GMP equalisation interesting, I think you can make anything interesting.
GMP equalisation is fascinating, Marcus. It really is. It's a story that goes back. We could make a film about this, actually. Maybe Johnny Depp or somebody could be in it. Goes back to 1990, when the European Court decided that everyone had to be treated equally. And at that point, GMPs were really part of the pensions landscape for an awful lot of schemes. They'd been running since 1978 as a way of contracting out of the state second pension, or SERPs as it was then. And when the Barber judgment in 1990 and then a subsequent judgment called Cullerole in 1994 told us how we had to equalise our benefits, what they didn't do is tell us what we had to do about GMPs. And that really has meant that for the last 20 years, they've been kicked into the long grass as something which is just a little bit too hard. And I think the intention has been that everyone just continues to ignore them and hopes that eventually they go away. Now, unfortunately, that hasn't happened. And what we've seen recently is the government re-raising the idea of equalising GMPs.
Okay, Paul, so that's all well and good, but why particularly is this being raised again now?
Well, it's a good question, and it's not... I think when you ask questions to the government and DWP, it's not actually because they want to raise it. It seems to be that they've had legal advice or they've had pressure from Europe, basically telling them that this is a position which has existed for the last 20 years and it's really not good enough that it hasn't been sorted out already. So there's an awful lot of pressure on the government to do something. I suspect if you actually ask them behind closed doors, they'd rather not do anything at all, but I think there's an awful lot of pressure where they have to. And if you ask the lawyers, there's also questions there about whether the lawyers believe it's necessary to do it. So from a legal point of view, it's debatable whether this needs to happen or not, but that isn't the issue for the government. They've been told it has to, and so they're pushing it at the moment. And with that in mind, they've produced this guidance, this consultation about how trustees and schemes might go about dealing with it.
Okay, so would you mind giving a little bit more background on the content of that DWP proposal?
Yeah, the technical description for the DWP proposal is bonkers, because that's really what it is. Now, imagine you have a situation where you've got two members. You have a male and a female. And this is a simplification, but for the purposes of understanding what the consultation looks like, I think it's helpful. The male is entitled to a pension of £10,000 a year, let's say, from age 65. The female is entitled to a lower pension, let's say £8,000 a year, but from 60. So the male says this isn't fair, she's getting her pension early, and the female says this isn't fair, he's getting a bigger pension than me. Now, either one of those benefits might be equivalent in value, but what the DWP proposal says is you have to pay the female rate, i.e. the £8,000 a year from 60, and then when you get to 65, you have to pay the male rate of £10,000 a year as well. Now, that clearly doesn't make sense. What's going on with that sort of proposal is that you're really pushing the benefits up to the absolute maximum they could be. You're giving both male and female more than they would have otherwise had. Now, the drawbacks from that method, as well as the fact that it's very expensive, is that the way the proposal is set out, you have to make that comparison every single year for the rest of the member's life. So effectively, every scheme would have to run two sets of records, one record assuming the member is male, one record assuming the member is female, and every year pay the best of the two benefits. Now, luckily, at the moment, it's only a proposal, and there's other ways that you could equalise GMPs if you felt it was necessary. But unfortunately, being the DWP proposal, there's a danger it gets more credibility than it deserves.
Okay, so I guess it's quite easy to criticise the existing proposal, but you mentioned there that there are alternatives. So what would they be, and are they genuinely any better than the DWP proposal?
I think they are, and there's lots of discussion with the DWP and others about these alternatives at the moment. The first thing that perhaps is worth clarifying is that GMP equalisation is not about equalising GMPs. It's about equalising other benefits to take into account the fact that GMPs aren't equal. So one proposal which has been put out is actually, why don't we equalise the GMPs themselves? Now, that would mean the government having to legislate to go back and retrospectively change GMPs so that they are equal in the first place. Now, it wouldn't affect the GMPs earned between 1978 and 1990, but it would mean that all the GMPs earned since 1990 effectively had to be recalculated and redefined by the government. So that's one option. The other option is really around doing something based on value. So, I mean, any trustee who's been through things like Section 67 certificates will have come across the idea of certifying that the value of people's benefits overall is no less than it was before a certain change. And it would be very feasible, in my view, to do some sort of test of GMP equalisation based on value rather than being based on the actual benefit every single year for the rest of a member's life. So I think those are all being considered, as well as a number of other technical points. They're all being considered by a range of pensions experts out there, including the DWP.
Okay, I guess, though, presumably whichever approach is taken, there are going to be some difficulties given this was all 20 or so years ago.
Absolutely, and that's where most trustees and companies start when you start having this conversation with them, is how on earth can we drag up this issue that we thought we'd put to bed 20 years ago? And imagine what's happened in 20 years. Half the members with GMPs have left your scheme, probably more than half of them. Some of them will have transferred out, some of them will have died, an awful lot of them have benefits put into payment already. Just tracking down these people for 20 years is a huge job. But even if you track them down, you then get things like a lot of schemes don't actually know what their GMPs are, because in order to confirm them, you have to go through a GMP reconciliation process with the National Insurance Office. So equalising something where you can't find the members and you don't know what their benefits are in the first place, and even if you find them, it could be worth tuppence halfpenny to them, just feels like the wrong thing to do.
Well, this is all sounds very complex. My head's starting to spin. And I guess the problem is then, for those of us on the call, is what we actually do about this. So what would your advice be to trustees, given the challenge that GMP equalisation is giving?
My advice would be very clear. Do absolutely nothing at the moment. But it's probably not absolutely nothing. It's probably understand the issues and then do nothing. Because right now it's a consultation. We really don't know what the legal stance is going to be. We can't know for sure that GMP equalisation is required. And even if we know it's required, we don't know that this method is a reasonable one. There is a distinct possibility that this all goes through and the government says we have to equalise GMPs. And even then, schemes do nothing at all. And there's various reasons you might do that. From a legal point of view, my understanding is that because this is to do with a discrimination issue, that there is a get-out on the basis of proportionality. Now, I'm sure if there were any lawyers on the call who weren't being muted, they'd probably give us an explanation of what that really means. But I think schemes can probably say, we've looked at this, we've considered it, and in the circumstances, given the size of the issue, we've decided to do nothing. And the question then is, who is going to challenge it? And I don't think the DWP will challenge it. I think the biggest risk is you do nothing and an individual member might challenge it. But given the size of the issue, I struggle to see why an individual would bother to do that. So very firm advice at the moment, do nothing. That may change over time, depending on how things pan out. But right now, I'm certainly advising my schemes to take no action.
Okay, so you're advising trustees to do nothing. I was right. You would be interesting. What about you, Ollie? What are you seeing employers looking to do in this area?
I thought Paul summed it up well with the word bonkers, and I'd echo his comments about doing nothing. My company clients have been contacting their trustees and just asking if they're comfortable holding fire on doing this until we see something more concrete in terms of guidance about what might happen in order to avoid running up at the moment on necessary time and indeed costs. Perhaps the one exception to this is where companies are involved at the moment in corporate transactions, such as mergers or acquisitions, whereby GMP equalisation is coming on the radar, and indeed in some cases being part of the negotiation about price. But even in those, I've seen few, if indeed any, where the price has actually been adjusted at this point to reflect GMP equalisation. Therefore, much the same, nothing on the company side.
Yeah, that's a good point about transactions, and I think it's not just corporate transactions, you know, with M&A. It's also things like buy-in and buy-out activity. You know, if you have something real going on where liabilities are passing from one person to another, you probably can't get away with doing nothing.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that just about covers off GMP equalisation, with a resounding call to do nothing except in certain circumstances. That sounds like good advice, to be honest, when there are so many other important issues to address at the current time. And to be honest, GMP equalisation could well become an unwelcome distraction, I suspect. So moving on to those other issues where not doing anything is not a sensible option, let's move on to 2012 funding valuations, the second item on our agenda. So, Ollie, what has been happening with funding levels over the past 3 years?
Well, as ever, Marcus, it's been a bit of a bumpy ride when it comes to funding. Perhaps start with some good news, though. Assets themselves have not done badly over the last 3 years. Indeed, at the end of last year, assets were broadly where we were expecting them to be when we did our last round of valuations 3 years ago. I've actually got one scheme whose assets have returned 20% on last year alone, which isn't a bad return on your investment. But sadly, this is countered with bad news, or particularly bad news, on the liability side, in the form that falling gilt yields, which drive our discount rates, have significantly pushed up liabilities on a like-for-like basis. Over 2011 alone, many of our trustees on the call will have seen their scheme liabilities rise by 30% as a result of these falling yields. The impact of this has been to wipe out all of those asset gains, such that schemes are finding themselves with the same funding position they were in 3 years ago. And from a company perspective, this is bad news, as they've seen themselves pumping in pretty significant deficit contributions over that period, only to be faced with the same monetary deficit today.
Okay, so what do you think employers' views are then on the current low gilt yields?
As you might expect, a company advisor, most of my company clients view current gilt yields as being a short-term blip driven by the latest round of quantitative easing and indeed investors' demand for our high-quality AAA-rated UK debt on which we set our discount rates. And to some extent, this company view looks to be playing out in practice. Over the last few weeks, we've seen gilt yields rise as Europe settles down a bit and the prospect of more quantitative easing reduces. In fact, jumping ahead to the budget, there was a bit of a bonus in there for pension schemes when George Osborne made comments about the introduction of a possible 100-year gilt to ease pension schemes' burden. And that actually saw gilt yields on that day alone rise 0.25%, which in funding terms is a bonus of about a 5% rise in funding levels. So once we follow that through, we find that we're actually now back on gilt yields to a position where we were in September. But companies still see this relative to what they expect long-term rates of interest to be as a low point. And therefore, companies are looking to work with trustees to make adjustments at this round of valuations for the lower gilt yields in order to avoid overreacting and contributing more than might be necessary to the plan.
Okay, well, that's all fine from an employer perspective, but trustees, I'm guessing, probably won't be as quick to suggest adjustments for these low gilt yields.
Yes, and understandably so, I think. I expect trustees will be nervous about making adjustments now that they might then find difficult to reverse out of their funding at a later valuation and view it that it could potentially reduce their prudence. So I see a lot of trustees will be looking to their scheme actuary for some guidance on this, and many indeed might play the waiting game of see what the company puts forward as their adjustment for the low gilt yields, rather than going first themselves and potentially weakening their basis more than they might otherwise have to. For those that are looking to make adjustments, say there's two main ways they might go about this. Firstly, you can change your technical provisions and therefore the deficit at the valuation date itself. Or secondly, you could look to make an adjustment in the recovery plan for future higher returns. And my expectation is, again, that probably trustees will opt for the latter, i.e. an adjustment via the recovery plan, as this gives them more flexibility for future valuations to reverse it out than if they change the current technical provisions. But one thing that all trustees will need to be mindful of if they're making any adjustments is a potential drift away from the buyout position. So regardless of what you're doing on technical provisions, buyout deficits have got worse because they're pricing off current markets, and trustees need to be comfortable with this. Perhaps to help those on the call, I can give a comment I had from another trustee, though, when they thought about buyout deficits, who were to say, we're just so far short of being able to buy out on the current market prices that it actually become a bit of a meaningless number to us, as if anything were to happen in the next couple of years, would be in the PPF regardless. Therefore, they viewed the technical provisions as more appropriate as a long-term, sustainable target to go for and agree a robust funding with their employer.
Okay, so what are companies and trustees doing then if they want to make allowance for these yields at the moment?
Yeah, as I said, there's two two ways that we expect companies and trustees to look to make allowance, either through the discount rate in the technical provisions or through the asset outperformance in the recovery plan, both of which can lead to a reduction in contributions now. The key to both of those, though, is that whilst short-term gilt yields are low at perhaps 1%, 1 or 2%, this has not changed our expected long-term rate of return on other assets, such as equities. So whereas 3 years ago, when your scheme actuary was perhaps talking to you about equities returning, say, 3 or 4% above gilts, based on a long-term equity return assumption of 8 or 9%, that will now be a return of 6 or 7% above gilts, based on the same long-term equity return assumption. And this can flow straight through into either the discount rate or the asset outperformance. For example, if we take a typical scheme with a discount rate of gilts plus 1.5% pre-retirement or gilts plus 0.5% post-retirement, then on a like-for-like basis, if we were to keep the same level of prudence in the valuation relative to your neutral assumptions, we'd actually end up with a discount rate of something more like gilts plus 2% pre-retirement and gilts plus 0.75% post-retirement, keeping the prudence the same. And similarly, the adjustment follows through in the asset outperformance. But as I said, this might be preferable for the trustees to put it here because there's more flexibility. Indeed, using an adjustment in the asset outperformance is an approach one of my clients took at a 31st or signing off evaluation at 31st of December 2011, which is about as bad as it got for funding. But allowing for those extra returns, they've actually not increased the contributions in their schedule of contribution from what they signed off before, and still indeed expect to be fully funded by the end of their recovery plan.
Okay, that sounds like some very sensible approaches that trustees may wish to consider. Are there any other things that you think trustees should be looking at this time around?
Yeah, as with anything, it's all about using the most up-to-date models. Why use an iPad 1 if you could get your hands on an iPad 3? And in the actuarial world, we've indeed moved our modelling on likewise, albeit perhaps not marketed it successfully. So first thing, as ever, is probably mortality. Couple of things to point out here. First, in relation to the actual tables, there's likely to be a new set of tables out there since the trustees did their last valuations, which we're calling the SAPS tables, or self-administered pension scheme tables. And these are based on the experience of occupational schemes, much as those on the call, rather than insurance company data. On its own, moving to these tables won't make any difference to the liabilities. It's all about how you benchmark them to your own scheme's experience. And here's where we bring in the first new model, which is the Aon Hewitt longevity model that if you didn't use it last time, you should talk to your scheme actuary about using it this time. This takes on board the experience data of your own pension scheme, how many of your pensioners have died, but blends in with this a postcode analysis of where they live and what proxy that is for their lifestyle, to get a real better handle on what your future life expectancies and therefore cash flows might be. There's also been developments in terms of those future improvements in life expectancy and where they might go. At the last round of valuations, most trustees were using the cohort tables, that's short, long, medium cohort, to project forward future improvements. We've now got another new set of tables. In this case, they're called the CMI projection tables, and they're published on an annual basis using the full England and Wales population data to keep on track of where life expectancy is going. To put that in context for your scheme, if you're on medium cohort tables last time, perhaps moving to the CMI will be broadly neutral. But if you're on the long cohort tables, actually it looks like they were overstating the rate of improvements in life expectancy. So moving to the new tables might indeed bring down your liabilities.
That's certainly my experience, Ollie. I mean, I was in with a client this week, and we shaved about 3% off their liabilities because we think the previous valuation over-egged the life expectancy, which I think is the first time in about 15 years we've taken that sort of message to a trustee board that actually people are not living quite as long as we assumed last time.
It's certainly one of the first times I've been able to go to my companies with some good news on longevity. Another one that's appearing on their radar, actually, if you can indulge me in a slightly technical point, is those that it's moving to a full yield curve valuation where schemes are currently using a single discount rate. We've just done a valuation with a client where the impact of this, which is effectively just modelling the liabilities more accurately, reflecting all the cash flows rather than one point in time, the impact was 10% on the liabilities, which if we think about the previous negotiations and how much time has been spent on mortality underpins that were perhaps 1% or 2%, a 10% difference is clearly huge and something that you wouldn't be surprised if the company might now be asking you to do more accurate calculations than before.
There's some really significant issues there. Now, as I remember it, the last round of funding negotiations, which were 3 years ago or so, they were very difficult for trustees because we'd just seen significant market falls in funding positions, like this time. And then subsequently, after valuation dates, there were some market improvements. Do you think the difficulty of those funding negotiations is going to be any better this time round?
Sadly, I think we could be in for another fairly challenging round of negotiations if companies and trustees take differing views on whether to make adjustments for the low gilt yields. From one perspective with the trustees, perhaps I shouldn't be saying this, but from one perspective it may be best for them to put forward their proposal first in order to anchor discussions to a potentially higher contribution rate. However, in my experience, quite often if this can have kind of a polarizing effect with the corporate looking to take very much the counter position, and you get into a bit of a standoff where no one really wins apart from us as advisors with heavy fees trying to get the parties together in a bit of a compromise that perhaps wasn't ideal. And actually I find funding negotiations work best when there's an open dialogue between the two parties. So perhaps I'd suggest there maybe trustees could be contacting their scheme actuary to suggest they put forward a valuation timetable for the company, and maybe even a joint training session on the low gilt yields and how that might impact this valuation, so that both parties can be starting with the same perspectives and indeed discussing their objectives and establishing common ground before incurring the expenses of lots of valuation calculations. But inevitably, there will be cases where companies and trustees cannot quite agree and will turn to their actuaries to see how they might just bridge that gap. I'll just give one example on that is a valuation I've just signed off where the company and trustee couldn't agree on the appropriate level of outperformance in the recovery plan, with the company not on expectedly looking to get full credit and the trustee a bit nervous of that because of the higher equity returns anticipated over gilt than last time. In this case, it was agreed that the valuation would be signed off using full outperformance and therefore reducing the immediate contributions for the company, but that the company would underwrite this, so at the next valuation, if returns aren't as expected, they'll pay in the difference as a lump sum. So in 3 years' time, provided the company's still around, which the trustees were comfortable with, the trustee will be no worse off than if they'd had their preferred funding approach.
Interesting idea there. In summary then, there's quite a few issues you've raised there, but if you were a trustee and looking forward, what do you think trustees with upcoming valuations should be doing right now?
Yeah, I think I'd go with a, rather than three, perhaps indulge me with a four-point plan and suggest that you go, first of all, draw up a valuation timetable and agree that with the trustee so everyone knows where they are. Secondly, organise some training on the impact of the low gilt yield environment. There are a number of new issues to consider. And ideally, if you can get that as a joint session with the company, you'll both be approaching it with the same views. Thirdly, again, engage with the company early on to discuss your objectives. Whilst we've not gone through it in the past quarter now, actually agreeing some long-term objectives or flight paths can be really helpful in making the valuation discussions easier later on and gives you a big tick in the box when it comes to submitting the valuation to the pensions regulator, as he very much likes flight plans. And finally, just make sure you're using the latest models out there, such as the Aon Hewitt longevity model, or moving to full yield curves, to make sure you've got the best understanding possible of your liabilities.
Okay, thanks, Ollie. How about you, Paul? Any additional thoughts you'd like to throw in there?
Yeah, a couple. I read somewhere in the last year that there's more cash sitting on UK balance sheets than any time in history. And as a scheme actuary, that says to me, not for all companies, but that says to me there is an opportunity out there. And it worries me that if trustees are too eager to hide the size of the deficits today, that they might look back in a few years' time and say, well, you know what, there was an opportunity to get cash from the sponsor in 2012. We didn't take it. What fools were we? So part of me says use every trick in the book to get the money if it's there. However, as Ollie said, there's a lot to be said for actually working this stuff in parallel with the company and the trustees, and if you've got that sort of relationship, I think it helps enormously. I do think that, as Ollie said, the current gilt yields are exceptionally low, and personally I believe they will only go one way, which is back up again. I don't know quite how far or how soon, but I think it does make sense, and what I'm certainly doing with trustees is to go to the company and offer something sensible rather than just sit there and try and defend the previous position and show the highest number. The other comment I'd make is in relation to annual updates. Even if schemes haven't got valuations this year, you will still have an annual update, and your annual update will look pretty awful. I think there's two questions there. One is whether you do anything about it, but for most schemes I'm giving advice that they don't take any immediate knee-jerk reaction because of the sort of issues that Ollie's described. And the other more practical question is, do you do anything to explain it to members? Because the next thing you'll have to do is send a summary funding statement, which will have a terrible number in it. And if my clients are anything to go by, 95% of the members won't even read it and therefore won't have any questions, but 5% will read it, they will see a huge number, and you'll be inundated with questions from those people. So positioning that, I think, is an important task that trustees can look at.
Thank you, Paul. Excellent. All good points, and I think we're certainly set for some interesting discussions in this round of 2012 funding valuations, for sure. So moving on now to our third agenda item out of four, and hot off the press, is the Aon Hewitt Mid-Market Survey. Now, Paul, would you mind giving us a top-line look into the results of that survey?
Yeah, absolutely, Marcus. The survey we ran this year was specifically targeted at, well, we called it mid-market. It was effectively schemes up to about £500 million. So these schemes, by number, are the vast, vast majority in the UK. The largest schemes in the UK do dominate in terms of asset size, but by sheer number, there's tens of thousands of trustees out there running schemes of less than £500 million. There's lots of detail in the survey, and if anybody wants a copy, by all means, get in touch with anyone at Aon Hewitt who will be able to help you. The big theme coming out of it was the fact that these schemes have nowadays just as many issues and solutions as the large schemes. They've got asset issues around diversification and liability hedging, and they've got liability issues around things like liability management and buy-ins and buyouts and PIE exercises and enhanced transfer values, and they've got governance things to worry about, and they've got triggers and flight plans and monitoring, and the list goes on and on and on. I mean, GMP equalization is another one. But they don't have the time, they don't have the resources, they often struggle with the expertise. And when we asked schemes about the things that worried them most, the things they were most concerned about, it wasn't funding position, and it wasn't their covenants or their investment strategy. It wasn't things like data. It was all about the resources. It was all about how on earth do I find the time and the expertise and to deal with all of these issues? How do I make decisions quickly? And that's really difficult. And I think the challenges in the mid-market in that area, it's certainly not unique to the mid-market. All schemes face those issues, but I think it's particularly challenging in the mid-market. The next obvious question is, so what do they do about it? I think it comes down to prioritisation. And if you really only do have so much time, so much energy, so much expertise, so much money, how do you make sure that that's being focused in the right areas and not being wasted in the wrong areas? And that might be by delegating certain tasks to where other people can do it for you. It might be by just looking at certain possibilities and saying, you know what, we can't do that this year. But that was a really interesting outcome for me, was that those constraints facing trustees.
And that's a very good point, actually, and it certainly seems to agree with the comments that many pension scheme trustees and sponsors are saying at this current time. Given the number of things that are going on at the moment, what actions does the survey actually suggest stakeholders are actually doing at the current time?
Okay, when you dig into more detail, closure is clearly a continuing trend. In the mid-market, something like 40% of schemes are now closed to future accrual as well as new members, and that's higher with the smaller schemes. So once you get below maybe £100 million, it's certainly in excess of 50% are closed to future accrual. A lot of people have got long-term targets in place now that are more than just the technical provisions, although a lot of schemes don't actually have a plan that will take them there. It's a target that they've got in mind, but perhaps not a robust plan to get there. We are seeing, though, an explosion in the number of people who are putting in place those sorts of robust plans and things like triggers. So about 20 to 30% of schemes now have some formal triggers in place whereby when they hit certain either funding positions or yields or levels of growth assets that they will start to trade. Combination of automatic trades and I guess what I'd call semi-automatic, where something is triggered but the trustees take one last look before they go ahead and commit. Wider than that, we're seeing the same trends on investment, which is a move away from equities towards matching assets. We're also seeing a move away from equities towards more diversified growth assets. And things like liability management. At the moment, it might be surprising that, according to the survey, only around 5% of people have undertaken either an ETV exercise or a pension increase exchange exercise. Now, given the amount of publicity they're getting and given the amount of attention they're getting from the regulator and from the pensions minister, you'd think it would be more than that. But actually, about 5% have done these exercises, but another 20% or so are interested in doing them, subject to the issues that, you know, do we have time to do it? Do we have the resources to throw at it?
Okay, so...
Sorry, that's it. Those are probably the main points.
Yeah, I was just going to comment that you've said trustees are very short of time, and then at the same time you've gone on to say that investment, flight plans, triggers and monitoring, they're all the kind of things that trustees are looking to do at the moment. I'm guessing then that delegation must be pretty high on the agenda at the moment.
Delegation is a really interesting one because on the one hand, trustees recognise the constraints they're under in a number of ways, the time, the expertise, the ability to act quickly. And in all of those areas, delegating certain decisions to someone else makes an awful lot of sense. But trustees are also under constraints in relation to cost. And the only way they can get somebody to take on those roles for them is to pay them to do it. So there's a huge dilemma out there as to how to effectively use delegation. I think delegation does, and I don't just mean investment delegation here, I think delegation of certain trustee responsibilities and duties absolutely has a place. And schemes already do it. For example, delegating to somebody to write the minutes of the meeting. And I think that what trustees need to be looking at going forward is making sure they have that balance right and making sure that they are delegating those tasks where it frees up their time in a cost-effective way. But absolutely, they keep the things that they really need to keep where they need to make a decision.
Well, I'd say from my company clients as well, delegation's been very much a supported ambition.
Very good. Right, well, thank you. And I think we should quickly move on to our final topic of the day now, before which I'd like to invite questions, so please get those questions ready for a few moments' time. And for our final topic, I'd like to shift focus towards the recent budget. So, Ollie, pensioners hit the headlines again last week in the budget as a result of the Chancellor's so-called granny tax although I believe the Chancellor himself actually adamantly claims that grannies are no worse off as a result. So I feel like putting you on the spot, in fact, because we're going towards the end of the call now. I'm being a little bit risky. Was it a raid on grannies, or are there other more important pensions issues in the budget that you think trustees should be thinking about?
Thanks, Marcus, for throwing that political hand grenade in there for me. Perhaps I'll keep it brief then on the granny tax. While in nominal terms they might not be worse off today because they got a good hike in state pension increases, I guess looking forward with the tax coming in, many may feel that they're going to be worse off in the future. But that aside, perhaps let me move on to what the budget meant for companies and trustees, which in actual fact was probably very little. It was a relatively benign budget from a pension perspective, with no further changes to the pension's annual allowance, as was widely anticipated. So the four key things to note here are, firstly, the government signalled that it's looking to move to a single state pension in future, so remove the state second pension, which looks like it could well spell the end of contracting out, and with that, I'd guess there'll be yet another round of benefit reviews for companies and trustees to go through once the detail of those company proposals become known. Second, the government proposed that state pensions will go up in line with improvements in life expectancy, which I think is interesting from two points. One, if you've actually with your scheme got benefits that are linked to the state pension, then you'll need to have a look through when this comes out and see how that affects your own scheme benefits. But secondly, it will just be generally interesting to see where the private sector pension schemes could piggyback on the back of any government changes to state benefits, perhaps a bit like the changes went through with CPI. Thirdly, there was a windfall, or certainly a welcome windfall, for companies in the form of an extra 1% reduction in corporation tax from next year, on top of the 1% already anticipated. So there may be some lucky trustees on the call now that find actually the companies trying to bring forward some contributions to get them in this tax year in order to benefit from the higher tax credit they can get on those. And finally, the government's pushing ahead with its project to get pension funds investing more in infrastructure. I think this feels like a good opportunity for pensions to perhaps get some extra returns by capitalising on the liquidity they hold in their scheme. So I'd recommend trustees pick this up with their investment advisors and see if there's any opportunities there for themselves.
Very good. Right. Thank you, Ollie. So that concludes the main part of our call today. I'll probably take a quick minute now just to summarise the key points that I think we've heard from Paul and Ollie today. On GNP equalisation, I think I heard that the trustees should do nothing, except in certain circumstances. On valuations in 2012, it looks like we're set for a fascinating few months discussing whether or not gilt yields are a blip, and if so, what we should do about it. And then on the Aon Hewitt Mid-Market Survey, we learned that trustees are very short of time, with a lot to do, and maybe need to think about what they can do to delegate some of those responsibilities. And then finally, on the budget, we had the benefit of all his insight, and we watched him duck that question of granny taxes, I think. So what I'd like to do now is to throw the call open for questions. We do actually have a question that was submitted prior to the call, so I can revert to that one if need be. But it would be great to get any questions live from those of you who are on the call today if we can. Now, in order to submit a question, I believe you hit star 1 on your phone, and that will open the line.
Yes, that is correct. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press star followed by 1 on your phone. Thank you.
I think this question you raised about the increasing state pension age is an interesting one. If trustees and companies really do have to try and apply that to their own pension schemes, it could have a huge impact. But I think if you thought RPI to CPI was difficult, you ain't seen nothing yet. If that's what is attempted, I think it will be hugely disruptive.
Some have done it for future service contribution rates, but certainly no one attempted looking backwards and doing anything.
Absolutely.
So do we have any any questions anybody would like to ask?
We have no questions showing at the moment, but maybe we'll just give you a few more seconds. Thank you.
Okay, well, I will just cover the one question that was submitted prior to the call, which actually wasn't connected with any of the agenda items on the call. It was all around Solvency II and what trustees should be doing around that. So I think I'll throw that one your way, if you like, Ollie.
Perhaps I'll start by saying don't do anything at the moment other than recognise that it might be on your company's agenda and they'll be getting a bit nervous about it. So what's it all about? It's a proposal from the European Commission to get some alignment across about funding requirements across Europe. And one of the proposals they've put in there is that companies should adopt the current insurance approach, known as Solvency II, for funding their occupational company pension schemes. Now, this hit the headlines because if we didn't make any adjustments to how insurers do it, then it could be a huge hit to UK PLC, with figures of £500 billion extra contributions being quoted as the outcome if this were to be adopted. So any company director seeing that is clearly going to get a bit worried about what might come from Europe. Since the original proposal, though, it's been somewhat watered down, such that companies and trustees would be allowed to implement a sort of insurance approach, but taking account of their covenant when building up how much money they need to hold. And this dramatically reduces the impact of introducing it to a place where I think for many companies we could actually be just a bit of a formalisation or of the current funding approach where we look at covenant and cash when setting technical provisions. So we're not expecting anything imminently on where this is going. At the moment, they're conducting analysis to find out exactly what it would mean in terms of costs, which is due out later this year. So I think for trustees, it's one to keep an eye on, but perhaps wait until the latter part of 2012 and see where developments go.
Okay, thanks, Ollie. And maybe that's worth putting on a future trustee teleconference, actually. So do we have any questions from the audience?
No, sir, we actually don't have any questions showing at the moment.
Okay, in that case, then I think that all that remains for me to do is to thank
sorry.
Everybody.
Excuse me, sir, we just got in one question. This is from Ken Murray. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Thank you. What does the panel think about the proposal that whilst gilt yields have fallen as a result of QE, the capital value of assets is higher, perhaps substantially higher than they would have been without QE? Thank you.
I think that's... It depends which assets you're holding. If you're holding gilts, then clearly that's the case. But most schemes are not holding gilts to anything like the same extent they've got liabilities. So there may well have been an impact in other areas, but if there is, I think it's personally, I think it's more marginal. But I think if you wanted a response on, you know, the relative impact on things like the equity market or other markets of QE, I think you'd probably need an economist with a little more insight into that area on the call than a bunch of actuaries, I'm afraid.
It is interesting because a lot of the rise in assets that I talked about over 2011 were indeed driven by the increasing price of gilts. But the fact that funding levels have fallen despite that, it just shows that most pension schemes out there perhaps only holding on average a third gilts. And it's interesting, when you look at the size of the gilt market, it's about £1 trillion, and yet we've got more than £1 trillion worth of pension liabilities out there. So it's difficult to a point where everyone could indeed invest fully in gilts, but that opens up a whole new world of where we'll go with pension investments.
It is, and the size of the gilt market, I mean, the other figure I find fascinating is that the government now owns, or is due to own with the latest round of QE, something like 40% of the gilt market. Now, imagine in any of your own businesses, if you decided to buy 40% of your own stock and keep it squirreled away somewhere so that nobody else could get hold of it, what would happen to the price of the rest of the stock you have? It would go through the roof. And that's what's happening with gilts at the moment, is the government has bought back 40% of what they've issued, and the price of the rest of it has gone sky high.
Excellent. Do we have any further questions?
I guess my supplementary question then would be, what happens if and when that HMG position is unravelled?
Depending on who you speak to, the impact of quantitative easing is anticipated to have reduced gilt yields by between 0.5% and 1%. So in theory, if QE ceased and all the assets were sold back, then yields could rise by 0.5% to 1% pretty quickly. I guess it's an incredibly difficult figure to pin down, but 0.5% to 1% increase in gilt yields would reduce your liabilities for almost all of your schemes back to a level where you suddenly felt very comfortable again.
That's sort of a 10% to 20% reduction in liabilities, which if you're holding, say, a third in gilts, could still be a 7 to 15 or something like that percent improvement in funding position.
Absolutely.
Okay, unless we
Thank
have
you.
Any further quick questions.
There are no further questions, thank you.
Okay, brilliant, thank you. Well, all that remains then for me to do is to thank all of you for listening in today and for the questions as well, and to thank Paul and Ollie for your valuable insights into the latest hot topics facing pension scheme trustees. So once again, thank you for listening, and I hope you all have a good day. Thank you.